Genocide is a terrible word about a terrible subject. Is genocide going on today in areas controlled by ISIS in the Middle East? Well, that's a subject of some discussion because, of course, ISIS only tells us what ISIS wants us to know. Recently, however, Secretary of State John Kerry declared that ISIS is engaging in genocide, a declaration with all sorts of international and constitutional implications. Today, we'll speak with attorney Ian Speer, who was instrumental in convincing the State Department to make such a declaration. He's going to tell us about his efforts, about the efforts of his client, the Knights of Columbus, and also about the significance of Secretary of State Kerry's declaration. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's about genocide.
It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Today's subject, genocide and ISIS, is an extremely unpleasant subject, but it was brought to my attention in a way that was actually rather pleasant. I often get suggestions for show topics from listeners, and a few months ago, I received an email from Kevin Jane. He's an attorney in Abingdon, Virginia. He's a regular listener, and he said, love your show and would really like to hook you up with a friend of mine. And the friend's name is Ian Speer. Ian is an attorney out in Colorado, and he specializes in representing religious organizations, including a group called the Knights of Columbus. And pursuant to that, he was asked by the Knights of Columbus to do something that's rather unusual for a lawyer. That's to put together a report on genocide in the Middle East, a report that was to be sent to the Secretary of State in an attempt to convince him that not only is genocide ongoing under ISIS, but it includes Christians and another group you may have heard of called the Yazidi. Here's Ian.
Well, my name is Ian Speer, and I am an attorney in Colorado Springs. I represent nonprofits and religious organizations. My work probably breaks down into, I'd say, three categories. One is I do a fair amount of First Amendment religious freedom litigation or advice and counsel for nonprofits and religious organizations. The second category, I do kind of general counsel work for these organizations. They, just like any organization, need advice on a variety of issues, whether it's corporate governance or employment or international issues, and I advise them on that as well. And then finally, I actually do some just general commercial litigation, and my experience there ranges from legal malpractice to intellectual property to just general commercial cases.
So you work for a large law firm that probably makes most of its money on that last category, the commercial litigation stuff. But then they are generous enough in spirit and in their pocketbooks to let you do all this pro bono stuff too.
Well, actually, the organizations we represent, at least in terms of the religious organizations, that forms a defined practice group within our firm. It's called our Religious Institutions Group.
So there's religious and people actually can pay you occasionally.
They can.
That's a nice bonus. That's good. It's
nice to be able to serve organizations that I care about, or at least serve causes I care about, and also to make a living at it. And in fact, that's one of the things that drew me to this firm was the fact that they have a practice group devoted to serving nonprofits and religious organizations.
Doing well by doing good.
Yeah.
I'm very glad to hear that. I'm always pleased. I didn't come up with that phrase, but I'm always pleased when I see lawyers who are able to combine those two, because it's often a difficult thing to do, especially in private practice. So congratulations to you and to your firm. You and I have never met before, but we have a common acquaintance. His name is Kevin Jane. And Kevin, you know Kevin very well. I really don't know Kevin personally. I'm sure he's listening now. He is, in fact, a regular listener to the show, and he is he's an assistant U.S. attorney, isn't he, in Abingdon, Virginia?
That's right. He is, and he and I clerked together for the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Oklahoma City.
Which is extremely impressive because, of course, the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, is one step below the Supreme Court. That's a very impressive job. The two of you must have done pretty well in law school.
I hope so. It was certainly a rewarding experience. We both clerked for Judge Jerome Holmes in the 10th Circuit, who's just a wonderful friend, mentor, and judge.
Tremendous. Well, Kevin then migrated out to God's country in southwestern Virginia, Abingdon, Virginia, one of the most beautiful places. Now, you're in Colorado Springs, you said, right?
I am, yes.
I understand they have mountains there, too.
We do have mountains. I get to look on them every day right out my window, which is also a perk of this job.
Not a bad thing. So the two of you both landed in nice spots. Kevin listens to the show, and Kevin emailed me actually a couple months ago and suggested this topic that we're about to get into. He suggested I speak to you, and I'm very grateful. Thank you, Kevin, for making the connection. But the topic is a pretty somber one. So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk about genocide in the Middle East. In fact, ongoing genocide.
Forgive me for interrupting, but I can't think of a more somber topic.
It's the lowest of the low points.
Lowest of the low. So I'm being serious here. This is not jocular. Okay, so we're talking about genocide in the Middle East. What's going on?
Since the summer of 2014, when the Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL, rose to prominence, they have been on a rampage across parts of the Middle East, particularly Iraq and Syria. They are a radical Islamic extremist group. They are intent on establishing, and they claim to have established, what they call a caliphate, where they intend to rule according to their interpretation of Islamic law. And it has been uniformly a disaster and a tragedy for pretty much everyone who lives there, all the groups who live there, but in particular religious minorities, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims, and not to mention the many other religious and ethnic minorities that live in these areas. ISIS's ideology is really to exterminate, or at least to drive these people out and to quote-unquote purify these lands so that they can rule in the way that they want.
So deportation, extermination, purification, these are all terrible terms that we've heard, certainly going back at least to Nazi Germany, and we've heard it in the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. And the word that always gets brought up in this context is, in fact, genocide. So is that what's going on there? Is that what ISIS is doing?
It is what ISIS is doing, and that has been recognized now by several governments around the world, including the United States. Genocide is a word that has both political weight and legal weight to it, and it's not a word that should be thrown around lightly. At the same time, it's a word that we should not decline to use if indeed that's the proper name for what's happening and for what ISIS is doing, particularly to Yazidis, Christians, and even Shia Muslims in Iraq and Syria. Genocide is the word.
Indeed. And you've used the term Yazidi twice. This, if I understand you correctly, is a Christian group that lives in part of the area that's been up until quite recently controlled by ISIS. Could you tell me a little bit more about them, since they seem to be prominent on the target list? ISIS targets a lot of people and a lot of groups, but the Yazidis do seem to have come in for their special ire.
Yes, and a slight correction, Stuart, actually, mm-hmm. Yazidis are not a Christian group as such.
They're religion.
Yeah, their religion combines elements of Christianity and Islam. I don't have a lot of familiarity with it, but I know that ISIS considers them to be not only polytheists, but in a different category than even Christians and Jews, who they call people of the book. And the Yazidis have been singled out even more than other minorities in the Middle East for extermination by ISIS. When you read their publications, and frankly, when you just see the pattern of of just horrific crimes against the Yazidi people, there is little doubt, I think, in anyone's mind, no doubt, in fact, that ISIS is intent on wiping them out. The Yazidi people, they've lived in these lands, in Iraq in particular, for thousands of years, at least as long as the Christians have. They have their own sort of distinct culture and religion, and they happen to live in the same places as Christians do. So in many ways, the Christians in Iraq and the Yazidis in Iraq share a similar fate, but ISIS has certainly singled out the Yazidi people for even more horrific.
Excuse me for interrupting, but this is so reminiscent of Nazi ideology. I mean, at the top of their particular fanciful hierarchy were the so-called Aryans, whatever that means. And then beneath them were other people, and then they would have degrees of people they hated. They hated the Slavs, and the Slavs were all going to be enslaved and killed. And they hated the Gypsies, and they were all going to be mistreated, and many of them are going to be killed. And, of course, at the very bottom of their particular hierarchy was the Jews, who were targeted for special dispensation, for special ill treatment. Is that what's going on here? Is that the ISIS will look down upon other Muslims, but will treat them with maybe some degree of humanity, look down upon the Christians and the Jews, but as you point out, they're still considered sort of related because they are Abrahamic religions, people of the book. And then it's other people, the so-called pagans, which include the Yazidis, which are singled out for special bad treatment. Is that what we're saying?
You know, Stuart, I think that's right. One of the things that we have to be careful about, I think, is distinguishing between ISIS's propaganda and its actual activities. Certainly, in its ideology or its theology or in its propaganda, it makes those distinctions. I think when it's, you know, practically speaking, when it's carrying out these horrific acts, it really makes very few distinctions. And its goal, again, is a caliphate where their brand of Islam and their ideology is supreme, and everyone else is either subservient or simply non-existent.
Right, but that's a key distinction. They would actually, if they had their way, they might actually tolerate, at least their theology, at least their propaganda says they would tolerate certain groups like Christians. They might require them to pay certain taxes. They might require them to operate under certain disabilities, legal and social disabilities, but they might actually tolerate them. But other groups, they wouldn't. They wouldn't tolerate at all. Those groups are only suitable for enslavement or extermination.
Certainly their propaganda would indicate a distinction between those things. And one of the issues, actually, surrounding the issue of genocide by ISIS is something called the jizya, which is a tax that was traditionally assessed against Christians and Jews living in Muslim lands. And ISIS acted like they were imposing the jizya when they would take over territory. This came up most prominently when they took over Mosul in the summer of 2014. Mm-hmm. And they suggested that they were going to allow Christians to live under ISIS rule and pay the jizya. The fact of the matter is, though, when you look at not only Mosul, but the entire Nineveh region, which is the northwest region of Iraq where most Christians lived, there simply are no Christian communities that are intact to any degree living under ISIS control. And in fact, when ISIS came into these places, not only in Iraq but also in Syria, they came literally raping, they came killing, they came destroying Christians and Yazidis' homes. They have completely wiped out all of the churches and the monasteries and any other kind of religious property that are in areas under their control. I mean, I think their actions show an intent to totally cleanse, if you will, these areas from any traces of of Christian civilization or of Yazidi civilization, and they may suggest that the jizya is an option for Christian people, but the reality on the ground is that they simply have not allowed Christians to live under their rule. They've taken all of their property and their money anyway and forced them to flee. So even if they wanted to, even if it were a real option, these Christians would not have been able to pay that tax. So I think, again, I think it goes back to distinguishing between what their propaganda says, which does seem to draw these distinctions, and its actions, which suggest that there really are none.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with attorney Ian Speer all about genocide and ISIS. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Ian. Stick around. Well, hello there, Cuddles.
Hey, how are you, Stuart?
Doing extremely well. I was just listening to one of our earlier quizzes, Doug. That was the one where you emphasized what a cuddly guy you are.
I have two young daughters. I have a beautiful wife. Uh-huh. I'm a cuddler.
I gave you a hug today for the first time. I really kind of enjoyed it.
You did. I'm a big bear of a guy,
too. You're a big bear of a guy. That's exactly right. Well, I'm so pleased, but you're also a guy who has brought a quiz.
I do. I've got a great quiz this morning.
A great quiz. Do we have a contestant?
Yes, hello.
Well, who are you?
I'm Rebecca.
Rebecca, where are you from?
Houston.
Houston? Houston all the way down in Texas?
Yes.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, that is still part of the United States, isn't it?
For now.
Okay, there has been no Texit, like Brexit?
No, there has not.
And I know there's been discussion of that. In fact, Texas has a long history of those sort of things, but I stray. Doug, do you have anything for Rebecca?
I do. Rebecca, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Well, I'm going to read a question for you.
Okay.
And then I'm going to give you four choices and we'll see where it goes.
All right.
All right. Here we go. What was the heart of the U.S. v. Texas case that blocked a major executive order of Barack Obama?
Ooh, recent history.
Recent history. This is recently in the courts. What was at the heart of the U.S. v. Texas case that blocked a major executive order of President Barack Obama? Was it A, minimum wage, B, immigration, C, abortion, or D, deployment of the Texas National Guard?
Oh, man, he was messing with the Texas National Guard?
Those are your choices.
Well, those are the choices. That's right. We have to have Rebecca answer this.
Yep. Four choices there. Minimum wage is A, B is immigration, C is abortion, or D, deployment of the Texas National Guard. The case is U.S. v. Texas, just in the most recent Supreme Court hearings.
Well, I'm not completely up to date, so I'm going to take a guess. And I'm going to guess immigration.
Immigration. So you think Barack Obama had an order on immigration that the U.S. Supreme Court blocked because Texas opposed it?
Yes.
Okay. You don't want to talk about any of the other opportunities. You're not worried about the Texas National Guard?
Well, I was thinking immigration because we're so close to the border.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that might be it.
Well, you could have taken the Texas National Guard and sent them down there to attack Mexico.
I guess he could have.
But he didn't. Okay. I can't get her off her answer.
Immigration.
Well, it's interesting because there was a major case on abortion that dealt with Texas as well, wasn't there?
It did. In fact, I'm kind of wondering what the answer is here. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm looking at you, Doug. What is the answer? Did Rebecca get it right?
And there was also Fisher v. Texas.
Come on.
Right? Texas had
that was affirmative action, I know.
They had quite a, quite a run at the Supreme Court.
You're just stalling. You're showing off.
It's immigration. B.
Immigration.
Yes.
Well done.
The key
well done.
Here is that it blocked an executive order.
Yes.
Of Barack Obama. Now, uniquely, this is a 4-4 decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that meant is that the lower court's ruling stands.
Right. If I recall correctly, and we've done an episode on this, the president was attempting to do through an executive order something that ideally, at least, is done through a statute. And that is to allow a bunch of people here who are not currently documented to stay indefinitely. Now, could he do this? There are arguments both pro and con on this, whether he could do it or not. But the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals out of Texas had ruled against him. So that ruling was the ruling. It was a nationwide ruling, not just in the Fifth Circuit.
And that's a lower court ruling.
Right.
Which is key here.
It's key here. So there are 11 numbered circuits throughout the country. So the case comes up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, because of the death of Justice Scalia, ties.
Ties.
So there's technically no Supreme Court ruling, but what that means is...
the lower court stands.
The lower court's decision stands. So that is probably the single case that is most significant in terms of showing the importance of Justice Scalia's absence on the court.
And uniquely, if President Obama's nominee, Justice Garland, or potential Justice Garland,
right,
had passed, who knows where it would have gone?
Chances are, I'm thinking it might have gone the other way.
My guess is that might have been part of the conversation.
It might have been
part of the vetting.
Who knows? Who knows? Well, Rebecca, congratulations on winning. You will get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. Also, if you will send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org with your T-shirt size and your mailing address, then we will send that T-shirt to you. And the gentlemen love that, Rebecca. They just love that. They know that you're a smart woman when you wear your YWC T-shirt.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you for playing.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Thank you. And thanks to you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
And then we cuddle. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. That was a fun constitutional quiz, wasn't it? I'm sorry to say that our topic today is not at all fun. I'm speaking with attorney Ian Speer. He's a fellow who specializes in representing religious organizations. And recently, one of those organizations, the Knights of Columbus, asked Ian if he would participate in the preparation of a very sobering report on genocide being perpetrated by ISIS in the Middle East. And Ian is telling us about how that report, it was one of the reasons that prompted now Secretary of State John Kerry to issue a declaration that genocide is in fact occurring in the Middle East. It includes not only Muslims, but other groups like the Yazidi and groups, including Christian groups there. And this declaration has not only a moral, but also obviously a political significance. And it turns out a great deal of legal significance as well.
Now we get into the really unpleasant part. Now that we've sort of set the stage, you've already suggested some of the things they've done. What has been the fate of Christians in this area? What has been the fate of the Yazidis?
You know, since ISIS invaded in summer of 2014, things have accelerated. But the Christian population in Iraq, in particular, has been in decline since 2003, since the U.S. invasion. In fact, I mean, in 2003, the population of Christians in Iraq was upwards of a million, and today it's somewhere around 250 or 300,000. So, some 80% of the Christian population of Iraq has just has either left, they've been killed, or entirely displaced. And like I said before, you know, all signs of Christian civilization, and all signs of Assyrian civilization. I should say that the Christians in Iraq they're called Assyrian Christians, and they trace their history to the Assyrian Empire.
Mm-hmm. Remind us what that is. Okay, it's not the same as Syria. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Correct.
We can distinguish it from modern day Syria.
That's right. Yeah, the Assyrians were a distinct people. They were not Christian. I mean, they predated Christian times. Mm-hmm. But there are still traces of that ancient civilization in Iraq. But those, ISIS has a problem with that history as well. And so they've wiped out not only the Christian churches and the monasteries, many of them dating back 1,000 years or more, but they've destroyed some of the cultural artifacts from the Assyrian Empire. And in turn, if you ask my history, I think I'd probably get it wrong.
That's all right. We don't need to go into that level of detail. I think the point here is that the Middle East is, you know, often called the cradle of civilization. That whole area is quite ancient, and people have been living there and building things and leaving behind artifacts for thousands of years. And as much as, of course, our focus is upon the human toll, and we'll get back to that very shortly, this is another aspect of it. These are treasures. These are things that belong, in some sense, to all of humanity. And they're destroying them. They're destroying the archaeological sites. They're destroying the churches. They're destroying documents. They're destroying all sorts of things which we might have learned a great deal from. And that's a terrible loss to all of humanity.
That's right, Stuart. I mean, there's certainly a human toll here, but there's also a cultural toll, and there's a wiping out of cultural, historical, and religious memory. And that's part of the genocidal campaign of ISIS. It's not only to kill these religious minorities or to drive them out of the region, but to wipe out any trace that they were ever there, and to, as I said before, to sort of purify the land so that they can rule it as they please. And it's just devastating for these communities.
I have to mention again, this reminds me so much of the Nazis and what they did in Poland, because when they went into Poland, they were determined not just to kill a bunch of Slavs and a bunch of Jews and a bunch of gypsies and homosexuals and whoever else they were targeting. They went in with the intention of wiping out the entire Polish nation, and they deliberately dynamited buildings and dynamited churches and destroyed archives. They were trying to wipe out any trace of the Polish nation. They obviously failed, but they did a lot of damage along the way. And so again, this seems to be part and parcel of the same sort of attitude among these ISIS people.
It is, Stuart. And, you know, the definition of genocide, I mentioned earlier that it has both political weight and legal weight. There's actually a legal definition, as you know. And that definition is actually fairly specific, which is why the word is not often invoked, at least not in a legal way. Mm-hmm. The definition requires really two broad elements. One is a set of acts that you might call genocidal acts. These include killing members of a particular group. It could include deportation, imposing conditions of life that are calculated to lead to this group's destruction, preventing births within the group. Those are the acts. Then there's what's called the mens rea, or this is the mental or intent element of the crime. Mm-hmm. And that intent element is, under U.S. law, it's the specific intent to destroy a particular religious, ethnic, racial, or national group in whole or in part as such. And that as such language really means it's an intent not to simply kill a bunch of people. It's an intent targeted at wiping out a particular group and wiping out really all traces of it, or even partial traces of it. I mean, you don't have to wipe out the entire group, but wiping out that group as a group, or sort of cleansing the land of those people. And I think both in term, if you look at what ISIS has said about its actions and its targeting of Christians and Yazidis and other minorities, and when you look at its pattern of activity, I think it's quite clear that they are intent on, they have the mens rea or the genocidal intent to do away with or destroy these groups as groups.
All right. Well, all of this seems familiar to anyone who's been paying attention over the last year or so, or longer, ever since the advent of ISIS, that this sort of thing has been going on. So how do you enter this picture? What role have you played, and what was the significance?
So there's a little bit of background to this. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum published in late 2015 what it called a bearing witness report, and the author of that report took a trip to Iraq and documented some of the horrific crimes that ISIS had been committing against Yazidis, Christians, and other minorities like Turkmens, and published a report in late 2015 concluding that ISIS had committed and was continuing to commit genocide against the Yazidis, but suggesting that the the definition of genocide had not been met for Christian minorities in Iraq.
Really?
Yes, and there was concern among activists who had been staying abreast of this issue and watching this issue, that the U.S. government would make a determination of genocide against the Yazidi people, but not also against the Christians. And like I told you, in many ways, these two groups share the same fate simply because of geography, but also because of ISIS's ideology and its actions towards both of them. So the Knights of Columbus, who I represent, contacted the State Department and expressed their concern that the genocide determination that was presumably forthcoming from the State Department would not apply to Christians in the Middle East. There wasn't a formal response.
Before we go on, I want to hear more about this, but what's the significance of declaring that this or that group is the victim of genocide? I mean, we all know ISIS is a bad group. The United States and other countries now are all fighting it. Maybe not as effectively as we'd like, maybe not as conclusively as we'd like, but we're already bombing ISIS positions and helping groups that are fighting them. What's the significance of including either the Yazidis or the Christians or the Jews or whoever in the definition of genocide?
That's a really good question, Stuart, and it's a really important one. I mentioned earlier genocide has both political weight and legal weight. Let me start with the legal consequences of declaring or recognizing genocide. For a state, let me back up even further than that. Mm-hmm. There is a international treaty called the Genocide Convention, which was adopted in 1948. It entered into force in 1951. Today it has, I believe, 147 states parties. The United States is one of those parties.
Okay, I'll interject here. Treaties are part of the highest law of the land in the United States pursuant to the Supremacy Clause in Article 6.
That's
okay,
right.
So if we're a signatory, then this is U.S. law. Okay.
That's right. And in addition to being a signatory to that treaty, the U.S. has enacted or implemented that treaty into U.S. law through what's called the Genocide Convention Implementation Act. And that statute makes genocide a crime under U.S. law. And the definition under U.S. law tracks the definition under the Genocide Convention.
Okay, that might seem common sense. It might seem common sense that if you're murdering people, you've committed a crime, but not necessarily, because normally speaking, the United States doesn't have any jurisdiction over murders that happen in some foreign country. But what we're saying through this convention is that if you commit genocide in some remote place, remote to us, on the globe, that you've committed a crime that can then be pursued in U.S. courts?
That's right.
Okay, so that's significant.
It can be, and it applies. The U.S. law applies. It applies in a variety of circumstances. One of those is if genocide is committed anywhere in the United States, which is a little unlikely. But it also applies if the offender, if the accused, is found in the United States. So if a perpetrator is passing through the United States or happens to be here for one reason or another, that person can be arrested and can be prosecuted before a U.S. federal court for the crime of genocide. Now, that situation is obviously going to be more rare. The treaty establishes international law, and it operates more at the level of states and, I should say, countries and countries' obligations with respect to genocide. And the Genocide Convention, the treaty, obligates countries to prevent and punish genocide whenever it's occurring. Now, Stuart, as you probably know, international obligations are oftentimes
honored and breached.
honored in the breach. There's no overarching body that enforces these laws. It doesn't mean that they still have this status of law, and countries still have those obligations. But what it means exactly for a country to prevent and punish genocide when it's occurring is it's not entirely clear and not always enforceable.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with attorney Ian Speer about a very sobering subject, genocide being perpetrated by ISIS in the Middle East. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Ian. Please stay with us.
On May 29, 1787, Edmund Randolph presented the Virginia Plan, authored by James Madison, which sought to replace the Articles of Confederation with a unitary form of government. The plan proposed a bicameral legislature in which the lower house was elected by the people, and the upper house was elected by the lower house. The Virginia Plan created a very powerful Congress, too powerful according to delegates like John Dickinson of Delaware and William Patterson of New Jersey, who raised concerns about representation and the veto power contained in the Virginia Plan. Dickinson argued that the state's interests should be represented in the national legislature, and he moved that the members of the second branch ought to be chosen by the individual legislatures. Madison argued against the motion. If an election by the people, or through any other channel than the state legislatures, promised as uncorrupt and impartial a preference of merit, there could surely be no necessity for an appointment by those legislatures. In this matter, Madison lost. The motion passed with a unanimous vote of the states. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with attorney Ian Speer, all about Secretary of State John Kerry's recent declaration that ISIS is committing genocide.
If this is recognized by the State Department as a genocide, if they make a declaration that it's a genocide and then it's occurring against a certain group, that means two things, that at least in theory we can prosecute the perpetrators if we can get our hands on them. Or that we have some sort of formal legal obligation, even though it's somewhat nebulous because it's international law, to do what we can to stop the genocide and to punish the perpetrators.
That's right.
So this is the significance, legally speaking.
Yes, legally speaking, that's the significance. And there's also a political weight behind that word. And so when you use the word genocide, it galvanizes not only public opinion, but it galvanizes the conscience of the American people mm-hmm. and of the world. And for a U.S. Official like Secretary Kerry, as he did in March of this year, for him to use the word genocide to describe these crimes is to lay down a marker. And it requires some political will and some political courage for him or any government to do that, because then the American people in particular can come back and say, all right, you've said this is a genocide. Now what are you doing about it?
Well, what are you doing about it? Right. It puts them on the record saying that this, we got a serious problem we've got to handle here, but we're getting a little ahead of ourselves now, and it's my fault. I made you digress. So, but I'm trying to bring this back in now. Now we know what the significance is. So you were saying that as of last year in December, there was some suggestion that maybe the Christians would not be included in any declaration of genocide. And so you and the Knights of Columbus got involved shortly after December of last year, and you were trying to get Secretary Kerry to make such a declaration and to have him include the Christians. So how did you go about doing that?
Right. So where I left off, Knights of Columbus had contacted the State Department, expressed that concern, and State Department officials got back in touch with the Knights of Columbus and said, we need your help making the case for why the Christians should be included in this genocide declaration. And so the Knights of Columbus then said, great, let's go. So they got me and my firm and my colleagues involved. They built quite a broad coalition as well of other activists. We were assisted greatly, in particular by a professor, a law professor at Catholic University named Robert Destro, and he was a key contact and also a co-author of the report that the Knights of Columbus eventually published. So we worked tirelessly for several months, you know, between the end of 2015 and March of 2016, and we went out and we scoured the public reports from NGOs and international organizations and governments and news reports for what ISIS had done since the summer of 2014, how that had affected not only the Yazidi people, but also Christians in Iraq and in Syria. We focused, by the way, on those particular areas because that's where ISIS is most active. I should mention, though, that perhaps some of the most tragically memorable events were ISIS's killing of several Christians on two different occasions in Libya. And you may recall seeing those videos or seeing news reports about those videos. So Libya is another location where these tragedies are occurring. But we focused on Syria and Iraq. Also, the Knights of Columbus put people on the ground. They sent a team into Iraq to do firsthand interviews and gather information firsthand from the victims and the survivors.
This was possible because in both Libya and Iraq, there has lately been a territorial shift. I mean, ISIS is being pushed back, at least in a territorial sense. And so you're sending people, volunteers, I assume, into areas that have now been retaken from ISIS.
No, not quite.
Okay.
You're right about the fact that ISIS has been losing territory. In fact, just since the beginning of this year, I think they've lost about 12% of the territory that they've had. And that's in part due to U.S. efforts in cooperation with Iraqi security forces to push them back and to retake some of those areas. The teams from the Knights of Columbus that went out went into the areas where many Iraqi Christians and other minorities have been displaced.
Oh, okay.
There are hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Christians who are displaced from their historic homeland in the Nineveh province on the Nineveh Plain in northwestern Iraq into Iraqi Kurdistan, which is an autonomous region sort of to the north and east of that. And they're living, many of them are living in what are called IDP or internally displaced persons camps. Mm-hmm. Others may be living with friends or with kind neighbors. Others might be in abandoned warehouses. It's a variety. I mean, there are almost 4 million people throughout Iraq who are internally displaced because of the ongoing conflict there. So the Knights of Columbus team went into Kurdistan and did some of these firsthand interviews and gathered firsthand information.
An astonishing array of information. You had an extremely extensive addendum or series of addenda to your report that would go through and document what these people had gone through, and it's just heartrending. Just one tale after another of rape and assault and death and all the rest of it. And so that's what you guys were doing. They were in the refugee camps and they were talking to people who had escaped from ISIS.
That's right. And the addenda that you're referring to, it includes both evidence from those firsthand accounts and the evidence we were able to gather from public sources. And you're right, it's really a sad read. But we were obviously very motivated to put that information together because we wanted to be able to tell the story.
Well, without being too critical of the State Department, it does seem to me to be odd that the United States government, with all of its resources and with all of its sources of intelligence and with all of its quote-unquote boots on the ground around the world, would ask any private party to take on the burden of documenting this in areas that may be relatively safe at the moment, but are still rather dangerous places. Any idea why they wanted your help rather than simply sending out their own personnel to do this?
You know, Stuart, I don't know the answer to that question. I guess I can think of two things. One is that, you know, Christian people and the church is, in some sense, a worldwide organization. And it.
And the Knights of Columbus are part of the Catholic Church, right? They're a Catholic group.
They are a Catholic organization.
Right, right.
Correct. And, you know, people of faith, they form a kind of family that stretches around the world. And so the contacts within the church are extensive and deep. And it's also, a source of solidarity and sympathy for the victims when you can say, our brothers and sisters in the faith in this part of the world are being persecuted, and our hearts need to go out to them. We need to help in any way we can. So I think for the State Department to ask the Knights of Columbus, it was easy for them to say, absolutely, we want to help in any way we can. And they already were on the ground in some sense with aid and other things. So that was a natural ask for them. The other thing is, I don't understand I'm not familiar with all of the kind of political controversy or political complexity that may be at work in the State Department. They're certainly balancing a number of objectives, and they're hearing from a number of voices. And they approached us, they approached the Knights of Columbus and said, help us build the case. And we said, we're glad to do that.
So they reached out to a highly motivated and extremely well-connected group that was already on the ground. Okay, that makes it sound more understandable, but again, they're the guys that have all the spy satellites, so this does seem odd to me to some extent. Okay, but you sent your people in, and they documented all of this stuff, you put it all together, and now I understand you entered the picture because you are actually one of the signatories on this report. I saw your signature down there.
That's right. I, along with my colleague Martin Nussbaum here at Lewis Rocha Rothgerber Christie, our firm, as well as Robert Destro, the law professor at Catholic University, who I mentioned earlier, the three of us are authors of the legal brief that was submitted to Secretary Kerry. And then, of course, we all worked on the addenda and gathering, the background information to that report. We put it together in what is almost a 300-page report called Genocide Against Christians in the Middle East. And we submitted that. We gave that to the State Department on March 9th or March 10th. That was 1 week in advance of what was a congressionally mandated deadline for Secretary Kerry to make a determination one way or the other about genocide against religious minorities in the Middle East. So again, March 9th or 10th, that report was published and released. The Knights of Columbus, along with In Defense of Christians, another NGO that works in this area, held a press conference to talk about the report and to feature some of the, to talk about some of the stories and the things that we had learned on the ground in Iraq. And within a week of that, Secretary Kerry, meeting his congressionally mandated deadline, made the declaration of genocide on March 17th.
So you all made a major contribution to getting that declaration.
I think that's true, Stuart. I want to acknowledge that we weren't the only group. We weren't the only activists. We were not the only NGOs who were fighting for this declaration, not only for Christians, but for the other religious minorities. There were many.
That's an important point. That's an important point, because someone who's just joined this conversation might be thinking, who's this guy and does he only care about Christians? I mean, I read your report. You made a point of saying that you wanted the declaration to apply to all to whom it was appropriate. You simply wanted to make sure it included Christians because there had been a suggestion that it might not.
Yes,
okay.
Stuart.
So you weren't there just for Christians. You were there for everybody who was suffering from genocide.
That's exactly right. We were not advocating for a declaration of Christian genocide to the exclusion of these other groups.
Right.
We simply wanted the Christians to be included in that declaration, both because it's true, and because. As I said, because of the kind of the political and legal weight that goes along with that word, which now galvanizes both public support and po- policy actions to help these groups and to somehow put an end to these atrocities.
Do you think the declaration has helped any? I mean, we noted that there has been some territorial progress against ISIS lately, and I note that recently there was a report in the paper, maybe just this morning, about the death of a major ISIS leader, the fellow who was in charge of all their outreach campaigns or publicity campaigns. Lately it does seem that maybe the tide is turning. Do you think there's any relationship between that declaration and the recent advances?
You know, Stuart, as a lawyer, it's hard to know. We deal a lot with, in our jobs and in what we do, we deal with the notion of causation. It's quite possible that the United States had determined that it was going to step up its activities against ISIS and implement some other policy objectives and simply made the declaration of genocide in conjunction with that. It's also possible that Secretary Kerry and President Obama had the courage to make the declaration and then to say, now we have to do something about it, and that was the marker or the motivator for what we've seen since then. But one thing is, or several things are true, and you mentioned them, that since that declaration in the middle of March of this year, the United States has in some ways stepped up its efforts against ISIS, particularly militarily, and I think that's honestly that's the place where it has to begin. The goal, the long-term goal, both for I think U.S. policymakers and for these persecuted groups in the Middle East, is restoration to their frankly ancient homelands. Mm-hmm. You know, the vitality and the solidarity and the long-term survival of these groups as groups is connected with these places where they historically have lived and worshiped and worked. And it, in some sense, it would be sad if there were no more Yazidis or no more Christians in these areas of Iraq where they have been driven out. So I think long-term, restoration to their homelands is the goal. In the short term, that means clearing out ISIS from these areas where it's in control. And if you follow the news, you probably know that in June, Iraqi forces with both U.S. support and honestly other countries' support, including Iran, recaptured the city of Fallujah, mm-hmm. which was an ISIS stronghold in Iraq. And attention is now turning towards Mosul. Mosul is Iraq's second largest city. Mm-hmm. It's in the Nineveh region, which is where many Yazidis and Christians live or lived. And the reports that I've seen suggest that Iraqi forces will be moving on Mosul by the end of this year. Now, the other country that's involved here, obviously, is Syria. Syria is even though ISIS controls swaths of territory in both countries, the situations in those countries are obviously quite different. And the Syria situation is particularly complex and particularly tragic. And it's tragic.
Yeah, we've all seen the pictures. It's horrible.
Absolutely. It's tragic for everyone there. It's not, the Christians are certainly suffering in Syria, but other minorities are also suffering, and majorities are suffering. Muslim people are suffering in Syria as much as anyone else, and the situation there certainly requires maybe a different solution than simply the military one, which is being pursued in Iraq, which is empower the Iraqi security forces and reestablish stability within that country, drive out or do away with ISIS.
Well, Ian, thank you. Thank you for your efforts, and you and the Knights of Columbus and your colleagues for bringing this to the attention of the Secretary of State. And thank you for sharing this very tragic tale with us today.
Thank you, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks not only to Ian Spear today for all of his efforts, but for listener Kevin Jane of Abingdon, Virginia, for bringing Ian and me together. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patiahau of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment and also of the human race.